Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, efforts to clean the Chesapeake Bay have been ongoing nearly four decades. The latest goal is to have the bay restored by 2025. But the rehabilitation of this treasured body of water is proving a heavy lift for Pennsylvania, which has been labeled the biggest polluter of the half dozen states in the Bay's watershed. Also, the peregrine falcon was nearly wiped out decades ago by the pesticide DDT, but today the population is thriving, even in urban areas. Arthur McMorris of the Pennsylvania Game Commission will be along with the latest on a nesting pair which has made its home high atop Philadelphia City Hall. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided it will not hear a case which challenged the Boyertown School District's policy allowing transgender students to use bathrooms which correspond to their gender identity, meaning a unanimous lower court ruling supporting the policy will remain in place, and transgender students in Boyertown will be able to continue utilizing the restrooms and locker rooms they feel comfortable with. What are the implications of similar cases making their way through the court system? Mary Catherine Roper is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union and was co-counsel on the Boyertown case. The ACLU represented the Pennsylvania Youth Congress. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
So this particular case called Doe versus Boyertown Area School District was, if I'm understanding this correctly, about perceptions of privacy. It was brought by a group called Alliance Defending Freedom, a conservative organization representing a half dozen students who wanted to overturn the district's policy. Mary Catherine, let's begin with the story of a transgender youth, Aiden DiStefano, who graduated Boyertown Senior High School a few years back. And you've told me he was the star witness in this case.
Absolutely. Aiden had grown up in the Boyertown area schools. He was transitioning even when he was in middle school. But when he arrived in high school, it just became a really important issue for him. He tried, he told me, to go into the girls' bathroom on the first day of high school and essentially was shouted out of the room by the girls because he has always presented very much as a male. So he spent most of his high school years using the bathroom in the nurse's office until he was a senior. And what had happened the spring before he became a senior student there is that the Obama administration, through its Department of Education, had issued guidance to schools telling them to allow transgender students to use facilities that match their gender identity. So when Aiden returned to Boyertown Area High School as a senior, then he could, for the first time, use the bathrooms and use the locker rooms. It is almost impossible for him to express what that meant to him. It was the fulfillment of everything he had been working toward for years, everything he had been building in terms of his personality. It gave him so much more confidence. His grades improved. He had a stellar year. It was huge for him. He was not the only student, by the way, but the first one.
So we'll talk a little bit about how Aiden himself approached this in school. But first, let's get to the ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom groups. They say in a statement, students struggling with their beliefs about gender need compassionate support. But sound reasons based on common sense, these are their words, have always existed for schools to separate male and female teenagers in showers, restrooms, and locker rooms. There was a question of one of the complainants brought a question of sexual harassment, who was said to have been embarrassed and confused when encountering a transgender student in the locker room. This is breaking new ground for many people. It's uncomfortable territory for them. How do you respond, in your opinion? How do schools respond?
Schools need to respond with sensitivity to everyone's need for privacy, which frankly is different from person to person. The vast majority of students in Aiden's school had no problem at all with transgender students joining them, the boys, with transgender boys joining them in the bathrooms or locker rooms. But some students are more sensitive to their privacy. And what the Boyertown Area School District did was create facilities where anyone, for any reason, could use a single-user bathroom. They were close to the gym. You could change in there, you could, whatever it is you needed to do. Basically, every student can set their own boundaries in terms of their need for privacy. That is a model, I think, for all school districts, while still giving transgender students the support they need to get through what is a very, very difficult time in their lives, the transition.
Let's talk about how Aiden DiStefano handled this at Boyertown High. He took the initiative, and according to a Penn Live report a couple of years ago, he talked to his peers, gave him a heads up at high school before he made the final switch to male restrooms and locker rooms. The quote from Aiden is, "I made sure my peers were okay with me going into that bathroom. I never got any questions at all because this is who I am." And it seems like this young man handled this in a pretty level-headed way. And also at the same time, you know, we've done a number of shows on bullying here at Radio Times. And, you know, one school culture might be very accepting, another school culture, not so much. So, you know, for the latter, perhaps should schools be thinking about some, not all, safety measures. The trusted coach might be within listening distance just to make sure that the transition for all works.
So that's going to depend on an individual school and what it knows about its culture. But understand, none of this happens suddenly, right? You know, Aiden wasn't going to school as a girl one day and showed up the next day and wanted to walk into a boys' bathroom. That's not how it works for any of these students. There is time. They often first start using different names, start dressing differently, presenting differently, joining different kinds of activities. And during that time, most of them are more comfortable in a private, a single user facility until they feel their own. And some of them never feel the confidence or the safety, because it very much depends on the school culture, as you said, to make that step into the group facilities. Schools need to be conscious of bullying for all students and for transgender students at every stage, because it is very, very common for them. It's hard for me to conceive of a situation where a transgender student would have had no problems at all just sailing through high school until that person steps into – that girl steps into a girl's bathroom, until that boy steps into a boy's locker room, and then all of a sudden everything changes. You know if you're going to need those supports, and each student and each circumstance is different.
Does this Supreme Court decision not to hear the appeal apply only to the Boyertown district, or does it affect other similar cases that might be working their way through the court system?
So the Supreme Court, by not hearing this decision, leaves in place a decision by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. That federal court sets binding precedent for Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey. But perhaps more influentially, it's the first Federal Circuit Court of Appeals to hear this question, not the question whether transgender students have the right to use facilities that match the gender identity, but the question whether when transgender students use facilities that match their gender identity, does that violate somebody else's rights? Does that violate a cisgender student's rights who is concerned about his or her privacy? And what the Third Circuit has said very strongly is, it is not, as the plaintiffs contended, sexual harassment under Title IX for a transgender student, a transgender boy, to walk into a boy's locker room. It is not a violation of privacy for a transgender girl to go into a girl's restroom, use the restroom, wash your hands. Those are the things that were at issue here. Transgender students are not offensive in their existence. That is the most important lesson to be gotten out of this, that if you are a student who is concerned about being around transgender students, you can protect your privacy in other ways. than by denying them access to facilities.
In a separate case 2 years ago, the Supreme Court vacated an appeals court ruling in a case called Gloucester versus GG. And just to be clear, we're talking about Gloucester in Virginia, not about Gloucester City High School in South Jersey. Tell us a bit about that case. We don't have a whole lot of time remaining, and where that stands.
So that was the flip side, right? Gavin was suing as
Gavin Grimm
was suing as a high school student for the right to use the facilities that match his gender identity. That case got all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, but it had very much turned on the Obama Department of Education's position on that. And so when the Department of Education changed its position, withdrew that position under the Trump administration, that really changed the whole foundation of the case. And so the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to hear it because the policy from the administration is no longer in place. By that time, Gavin had graduated. So in essence, he never got his full day in court.
So were we talking about an interpretation of Title IX here?
In Gavin's case, we were talking about an interpretation of Title IX, that he said he had a right under the sex discrimination prohibitions under Title IX to use the same facilities as other boys. In the Boyertown case, again, it's the complete flip side. The cisgender students, the students whose gender identity matches the sex they were assigned at birth, who felt uncomfortable with transgender students, they were trying to use Title IX to say it is harassment for someone I don't consider a girl to join me in the girls' restroom. Or it is an invasion of my constitutional right to privacy. They argued that the Constitution forbids transgender girls using girls' facilities, boys using boys' facilities.
Mary Catherine Roper, the makeup of the Supreme Court, of course, has changed under the Trump administration. How do you see decisions moving forward? I'm asking you to just kind of take a look into the future here. In the near future, as far as cases concerning this sort of issue are concerned.
So this term, the Supreme Court will consider not anything having to do with the school context, but in the employment context, whether Title VII, our federal anti-discrimination statute, whether the sex discrimination provisions in that apply to transgender people in the workplace. Again, that is analogous to Gavin Grimm's claim when he was seeking access to facilities at his high school.
We only have about 15 seconds left. I'm sorry.
It is completely different from the novel claims of the plaintiffs here that the Constitution actually forbids this kind of inclusion of transgender people.
Mary Catherine Roper of the ACLU, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a couple moments, we talk about the Chesapeake Bay and the fact that Pennsylvania apparently is not doing its share in terms of trying to reduce pollution in the watershed. That's just ahead on Radio Times. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Chesapeake Bay has been called a national treasure, but the tarnish of pollution coming from states in the Bay's watershed has threatened the health of this precious resource for decades. In 1983, efforts to restore the bay began in earnest, but the early going was tough, and in 2010, the Chesapeake Clean Water Blueprint was developed to accelerate recovery with a new cleanup goal of 2025. According to the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, three states in the watershed are responsible for 90% of the pollution: Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. And in a recent assessment, Pennsylvania was found to be the worst offender and way off track in its goals to reduce pollution. Here to tell us more is Kate Fritz from the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Mari. It's good to be here.
So first, a little geography refresher. There are a total of six states which are part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We've talked about Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia. Who else?
Sure. There are actually six states in the District of Columbia. The Chesapeake Bay starts up in Cooperstown in New York, flows down through Pennsylvania, enters Maryland, West Virginia, the District, Virginia, and Delaware.
Describe the bay itself just a little bit. It's known, Kate, for what sorts of wildlife and plant life?
Absolutely. It's actually the largest estuary in the United States, which means it's a shallow body of water that is really a useful estuary and habitat for birds and fish in the watershed. Important keystone species like bald eagles and our osprey nest here and depend on the Chesapeake Bay as a nursery for fishing and feeding. And then up in the Susquehanna watershed, our landscape is really well known for its forests and the endangered species up there, and a lot of our brook trout and depend on clean freshwater streams. So it's a habitat to a lot of important species that we depend on, and especially species like the blue crab and the oyster here down in the tidal portion of the Chesapeake Bay.
And of all the states in the Bay's watershed, Pennsylvania is by far the biggest polluter. Why?
Well, Pennsylvania has the biggest lift. They have the Susquehanna River itself is the largest drainage area into the Chesapeake Bay. It delivers about 50% of the fresh water that comes down here into what we call the tidal portion, which is where it gets salty down here in Maryland. Pennsylvania is a large, because of the large land area, has a lot of impact on what comes downstream. There are about 33,000 farms in the Susquehanna River basin up in Pennsylvania throughout 43 different counties that drain down to the Chesapeake Bay. And the challenge for Pennsylvania is that Pennsylvanians don't really see the actual Chesapeake Bay, but instead are focused on their local rivers and streams in their backyard. So Pennsylvania has the largest way to go to clean up through our efforts as we march up to our goals for 2025.
Kate Fritz, I understand that you work directly with farming communities in Pennsylvania.
We do.
What are you hearing from them in terms of their challenge in trying to meet these cleanup requirements, and what are you asking from them?
Absolutely. So we work on the ground up, specifically been working with the agricultural community, the dairy community, specifically up in Lancaster County in Pennsylvania. And when we're on the ground with our farmers, we hear oftentimes that they want to do the right thing. They are concerned about their land and the way they manage their land and livestock. They are from, they depend on the land up there and they want to be good stewards. So we know the farmers want to do the right thing. The challenge is sometimes that the margins on farming don't make it easy to do the right thing in terms of having resources to do that, to bring action on the ground. So that's where we've been working with in partnership with many of the farming communities. And one of our partnerships I want to talk about is the Clean Water Partnership with Turkey Hill Dairy and the Maryland and Virginia Dairy Co-op up in Lancaster. Mm-hmm. And we've been working with them to help help provide resources to their farmers in order to do work on the ground.
What sorts of resources, and what do they really need to tighten up in order to help reduce pollution?
Sure. So we've in coordination with Turkey Hill Dairy, the Alliance have secured about $1.5 million in grant funding to bring to on the ground actions for farmers. So things like installing manure storage sheds or planting riparian buffers along their streams so that pollutants don't get into the stream in the first place. So we're helping bring some actionable dollars that are being utilized on the ground by the farmers. And then at the same time, Turkey Hill Dairy, being a good steward and of both their land and of their dairy producers, is helping incentivize producers that come into compliance with their conservation plans by giving an incentive on per pound of milk, which will help their bottom line as producers. So the Turkey Hill company itself is also providing an incentive, and the Alliance is helping bring some resources to bear for on-the-ground action.
Okay, other pollution points. Pennsylvania is being given points for being on target and meeting wastewater goals?
Yep. We will say, we know that Pennsylvania, the watershed implementation plan that they just submitted is only going to get them about 70% of the way to their 2025 goal. But what we really want to lift up is how Pennsylvania has come together. There's an unprecedented level of coordination between the state agencies. The state has also worked with each of the 43 counties in Pennsylvania to help them prepare their own watershed implementation plans, which is the local roadmap for how the pollution reduction work is going to get done. And I want to highlight really that in Lancaster County alone, which has about 21% of the state's nitrogen to reduce, has created and submitted a plan where they will meet 100% of their goals by 2025. Just to put that in perspective, Marty, Lancaster County in Pennsylvania has more farms than the entire state of Maryland. So there's a really large challenge ahead of them that's going to demand a lot of attention and a lot of coordination and a lot of resources to be focused up there.
How do nitrogen and phosphorus harm the Chesapeake Bay?
Nitrogen and phosphorus are the fuel for things like algae blooms down here in the tidal portion of the Chesapeake Bay. So as nitrogen and phosphorus enter our waterways, our algae, they eat that and they grow, and they will then shade themselves out and die. And when they get to the bottom of the water column, they tend to eat up the oxygen, suck up the oxygen, which causes dead zones. So it's a real important effort that we have to really reduce the nitrogen and the phosphorus, which is stuck to the soil and the sediment that comes off of our lands, to reduce that from coming into the tidal portion of the Chesapeake Bay.
We are talking about cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Kate Fritz, who is Executive Director of the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay. So, Kate, what does 2025 look like if all goals are met? Is the Chesapeake Bay clean?
If all goals are met in 2025, and I'm going to remain very hopeful that we are headed to shoot and meet that target, I think what we'll be seeing is a resilient Chesapeake Bay. I think at this point, the Chesapeake Bay that John Smith saw when he was traveling is one that we likely won't see again for future generations. But instead, it's an optimistic future about a resilient Chesapeake Bay that's able to, that has wetlands and forests that are intact and are able to take the challenges of climate change and provide, you know, the free ecosystem services that they do for all of the 18 million residents in this watershed, and help really bounce back from climate change impacts like the larger hurricanes that we're seeing, the nuisance flooding that's increasing, like in cities like where I live here in Annapolis. And I think a resilient Chesapeake Bay itself will also lead to a resilient community. And, the people are as much part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed as the flora and fauna.
What do hurricanes and what does flooding do negatively to the bay?
Sure. Hurricanes and flooding can often cause different salinity challenges, which means that when it rains a lot, we get large spikes of fresh water into the Chesapeake Bay, and that can often damage our oyster populations up at the top of the bay, who depend on salty water to survive. That can certainly have a negative challenge. And then with any event where there's large wind, it mixes our water column, which mixes our pollutants back up and suspends it. And if you've ever seen a local river or stream after it rains and seen how chocolate brown it is, that's wind mixing can do to the whole Chesapeake Bay. So it can really cause some very substantial challenges.
There has been some good news to report recently. According to the Chesapeake Bay Foundation's State of the Blueprint report for this year, blue crab populations and underwater grasses are rebounding, but at the same time, the report cautions that recovery is fragile.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep. We saw record rainfall across the whole Chesapeake Bay watershed last year, which is really going to pose an immediate and present challenge to the work that we are doing, the Alliance is doing on the ground with our partners up in Pennsylvania and across the other states. I believe Pennsylvania has already surpassed their record rainfall from last year already this year. So these challenges are ever present. We can't stop. We can't take our foot off the pedal at this point, not with climate change challenges knocking on our back door. And so, the Alliance, our goal is to get different sectors working together. We work with the government, we work with businesses, we work with the conservation community, the farming community on the ground to do work to leverage different resources to bring clean water actions on the ground.
Speaking of climate change
will stress that.
Speaking of the government, how do you find Pennsylvania Governor Wolf? Is he environmentally friendly? Is he on board with all this? Are you getting enough help from the state?
Governor Wolf is certainly environmentally friendly. We are excited that he is sitting representing Pennsylvania. He is a former board member of the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay, so he is one of our alumni and understands the challenges. And one of the things that we're seeing out of his administration that we are so excited about is the coordination with all of the state agencies, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Conservation, Natural Resources, and the Department of Environmental Protection. There's an unprecedented level of coordination coming out, and I do believe that Governor Wolf has been driving that.
How much money does all this cost? I mean, we talked about it a smidge, but, it's not inexpensive to curtail pollution. And is the Republican-led legislature amenable to to providing the funding?
Funding is a challenge in Pennsylvania, certainly. I think the price tag to meet the 2025 goals is north of $275 million, if not more. And I think politics aside, I think there's some new and innovative funding sources coming online, specifically up in Pennsylvania, that will help Pennsylvania meet its goals. And one of the things we're excited about at the Alliance is helping bringing private financing and private funding to the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Movement up in Pennsylvania to help expedite some of the work and get to our 2025 goals together.
One more pollution point here with Pennsylvania's stormwater runoff. What are the challenges here, and what does Pennsylvania need to do to curtail such runoff?
Stormwater runoff continues to be a challenge because our pace of urban development continues to increase. We're predicted to get a couple million more people moving into the Chesapeake Bay watershed in the next 5 to 10 years. And so urban development will mean that farms are turning over into urban sprawl, where we're creating rooftops and runway or driveways and highways that are not allowing the water to soak into the ground, but instead run off into our local streams and erode them. So that stormwater challenge continues to be real and present, especially when industries, traditional farming industries like the dairy industry, is being challenged by the price of milk, and farmers are looking to other opportunities to make money. So I think continuing to take a real look at urban development in Chesapeake Bay and Pennsylvania, but all over the Chesapeake Bay, is a really important and paramount issue that we can't let up on.
What's in stormwater runoff that might damage the bay?
Stormwater, if you've ever stood out in a parking lot on a 105-degree day, you know how hot parking lots can be. And
sure.
So every time it rains in the middle of the summer, think about that water rushing off of that parking lot. It's picking up the heat from the asphalt. It's picking up the pollutants, any trash or oil that's on the parking lot, and it's going rushing into our local streams. And what we find is that the speed of the water and how much the volume of water, because we're getting these really intense storms in very short periods of time, are rushing through a pipe directly into our streams and eroding down the streams. And that's what's causing a lot of pollution into the bay. So it's a lot of what's coming off of our what we call impervious surfaces, our surfaces where mm-hmm. water can't go through. And then it's rushing directly into our streams and eroding them. That's our biggest challenge.
Okay, Fritz, anything listeners can do to mitigate the effects of pollution, listeners in Pennsylvania and also Delaware's part of the watershed?
Absolutely. We can all do something. So everybody who lives within your listening audience lives within the Chesapeake Bay, probably, and everyone has an opportunity to take an action on their own. Coincidentally, we are at the start of Chesapeake Bay Awareness Week, and I highly encourage anyone interested in learning more to visit our website at allianceforthebay.org. We have issued what we're calling a Chesapeake Challenge, and we've issued a pledge for citizens, stakeholders, businesses, government to commit to changing one action in their life every day for a better Chesapeake Bay. So we've been encouraging, yesterday we were encouraging proper land, lawn management. The day before,
meaning what?
We were encouraged to not fertilize right before it rains, or to leave your grass clippings on your lawn to help fertilize them instead of taking them away. We encourage people to pick up after their dogs. We know that bacteria from dog waste can enter our streams and really negatively impact our streams.
And it can make that much of a difference.
Absolutely. And then today we're talking about how you can green your own business. And we've got a blog and some action items about different actions you can take in your business to reduce single-use plastic, to increase recycling, which all have an important impact on the Chesapeake Bay.
So, Kate, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Chesapeake Clean Water Blueprint is a federal-state initiative, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So it was enacted in 2010 during the Obama administration. What is the EPA's role in the blueprint now under the Trump administration? Has it changed?
The EPA is still helping lead the partnership, what is called the Chesapeake Bay Program. The partnership is a partnership of federal agencies, state agencies, local governments, NGO community, businesses, et cetera, that are all working towards the 2025, what we call the total maximum daily load, the TMDL. It's basically the Chesapeake Bay pollution diet. And the EPA has maintained that position in helping coordinate the partnership, and we have not luckily seen much of a change within the administration. There have been some challenges to potentially federal funding through the president's budget. He did zero out the Chesapeake Bay program last year. But we have such engaged and concerned elected officials that they have made sure that the Chesapeake Bay is fully funded in the federal budget. And I believe there's a proposal for increase to the Chesapeake Bay program within federal funding as well. So we're encouraged to see $83 million versus the kind of the $78 million that the Chesapeake Bay program has been receiving over time. And so we continue to fight to maintain that funding. And it's a great effort to see the entire watershed and all of our elected officials working together in that vein.
Okay. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation report also takes a look at progress in other states. Any concerns where Delaware is concerned?
Delaware is a small portion of the watershed, and I've been really impressed with the efforts going on in Delaware. Little tiny jurisdictions like Laurel, Delaware, have done an incredible amount of work and greening their own space as they revitalize their city and doing a lot of green infrastructure work and understanding that tourism and green infrastructure and environmental practices can go hand in hand. So kudos to Laurel for the work, to Delaware for the work that they're doing.
And the foundation report, the other two major polluters, well, behind Pennsylvania, were Maryland and Virginia. How are they doing?
Yep. Maryland and Virginia are on track to meet 2025 goals. In Maryland, we continue to focus on wastewater and agriculture. And in Virginia, wastewater again and agriculture continue to be two major sources where the states are looking to help make reductions. Maryland has recently upgraded all of their major wastewater treatment plants. And so that's been a large driver of how the state is looking to achieve their goals. And in Virginia, there's a lot of focus on shoreline management as well. Virginia has a lot of shoreline on the northern neck that stands to erode with the rising seas and the challenging storms ahead.
We've got about 10 seconds left, Kate. What your wish list for the Bay, how would you fill it?
If everybody woke up every morning thinking about the Chesapeake Bay and what one thing that they can do to help impact the Bay, that is my wish for it.
All right. Kate Fritz, Executive Director of the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Marty.
Up next, it's Arthur McMorris, Peregrine Falcon Coordinator for the Pennsylvania Game Commission. We're going to be talking about a nesting pair of Peregrine Falcons, which has made its home atop City Hall. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. You are listening, or we're listening, to the sound of some rather angry peregrine falcons. Every year, Arthur McMorris goes out on a ledge high atop Philadelphia City Hall to visit and check up on a nesting pair of falcons. We'll talk about the welcome he gets in just a moment. The female has made City Hall her home, I think, for about 9 years. Her mate is relatively new, and Art makes the pilgrimage to the 15th level to determine, among other things, whether the pair has successfully produced any babies. The fact that these birds of prey live and thrive atop City Hall or anywhere else in the Delaware Valley is a compelling environmental comeback story. The species was virtually wiped out in the eastern U.S. by 1961 because of the pesticide DDT. To the layman, the recovery effort can seem a spectacular success, but despite its progress, the peregrine falcon is still considered to be a threatened species. And for the remainder of the hour, we'll talk about this beautiful bird of prey and what the future might hold with Art McMorris, Peregrine Falcon Coordinator for the Pennsylvania Game Commission. Hello, Art.
Hello, Mary. Thank you so much for inviting me to come here.
Oh,
it's a pleasure.
Of course. It's a great story. So you were just at the nest a couple of weeks ago. You were there to give the babies, if there were any, a checkup?
Yes, exactly. We call this a nest visit. We sometimes call it a banding visit, but we do more than just band the young. The primary thing is to find out just what the results are at the nest. At City Hall, we could see into the nest, or volunteers could see into the nest from the tall building just south of City Hall. But at many other nests, we can't tell really what the results are unless we go there. So that's one thing that we want to do, is to verify the results of the nest. The second thing is to give health checks to the young, and we give them treatment if necessary. The third thing is to identify their parents so that we can track the population and its recovery. And then the fourth thing is to band the young. We put numbered bands on their legs, which we put two bands on, one band on each leg, and the one that goes on the left leg has very large characters which can be seen on a free-living bird with binoculars or in a good photograph. And this is our most important tool for tracking the population and answering questions like, how long do these young live? Where do they go? Do they nest successfully somewhere else? Is Pennsylvania a population source? That is, do we produce enough young in Pennsylvania to help support the stability and the growth of the population in Pennsylvania and throughout the northeastern United States and eastern Canada? How many young, if they are found breeding, how many young do they have in their lifetime, et cetera? These are all very important things to know to track the recovery of the population.
And all this is because the peregrine falcon is still threatened, but still it's made an astounding comeback. There was nothing here. There were no peregrine falcons in the state in the early 60s, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Peregrine falcons were actually wiped out in North America, east of the Rockies and south of the Arctic by DDT. DDT was used heavily for agricultural purposes after World War II. It was actually developed during the war to fight typhus in Europe and malaria in the South Pacific. And then it was used heavily for agricultural purposes after that. I can remember as a child running through the fog produced by the fogging machines that came down our residential street to fog the trees.
Oh, dear.
It was used. It was thought to be harmless to anything other than insects, but now we know better.
Well, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Rachel Carson.
She's a Pennsylvania person.
Absolutely, absolutely, and we're very proud of that. Her Silent Spring in 1962 really sounded the alarm about DDT and its hazards to wildlife.
Weakening eggshells, correct?
That's the major thing that it did. It disrupts calcium metabolism in the birds, and the result is that they laid eggs with shells so thin that they simply broke and the egg died. The last successful nesting in Pennsylvania was 1957. The last thorough survey of the eastern United States and eastern Canada in 1964 revealed no successfully nesting peregrine falcons anywhere.
So before we get to the nesting pair atop Philadelphia City Hall, just briefly, what happened to bring about the comeback?
There was a person who sadly died earlier this year. His name is Tom Cade. He's an ornithologist. He was an ornithologist and a falconer. He worked at Cornell University. And he had the bright idea of, well, all we have to do is raise peregrines in captivity and turn them loose. It was pointed out to him that this had never been done before. In spite of falconry being at least 2,000 years old and probably twice that old, no one had ever even tried to breed peregrine falcons in captivity. One thing that peregrines do when they're nesting or when they're courting and breeding is they conduct these dramatic aerial displays to each other over many square miles of airspace. How do you do this in captivity?
Sure.
And he said, I'm paraphrasing now, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Nothing to lose, right?
That's right. So they tried, and falconers did have peregrines in captivity from seven different subspecies from all around the world that had not been fed food contaminated with DDT. So falconers contributed their birds to the captive breeding program. It worked. It worked better than anybody ever imagined that it could, except perhaps Tom Cade. More than 2,600 birds were released in the eastern United States, more than 7,000 overall in North America. There were a lot of false starts. For example, the first few that were released, young birds that were released at Cliff nesting sites.
But that's where they normally like to be.
That's where they normally like to be. And before humans started building tall bridges and tall buildings, that's where peregrines nested, on ledges, on cliffs, which protect them from terrestrial predators like foxes or skunks that would eat the young. And the cliffs also give them view of lots of open air space, which they need for hunting. And cliffs are typically over rivers. Certainly Pennsylvania's cliffs are. And the water helps support a prey base, a base of smaller birds.
That's what they eat, smaller birds.
Yes, they eat birds. Anything that's big enough to be worth the trouble and not too big to handle. So anything from chimney swifts up to small and medium-sized ducks and gulls they will take. They will take whatever's available. So they nested on cliffs, and now in the recovery period, they have adopted artificial cliffs that humans have built for them.
Which brings us to Philadelphia City Hall.
Yes.
What are the – I'd like to get to the actual nest itself, but very quickly, what are the hazards of living in the city? I mean, these birds dive at 200 miles an hour.
That's correct.
You get? I mean, there's so little space to pull that off. No?
There's lots of open air space. They don't live near the ground. They live up high.
Okay.
So in cities, there's plenty of air space. Living in cities has its pluses and its minuses. The pluses are that there are these artificial cliffs. The pluses are that there's an abundant supply of prey in the form of urban pigeons and starlings and things like that. I've been quoted as saying, if you wanted to design a bird that would be perfect prey, perfect food item for peregrines, you design a pigeon. So they don't
move very fast.
They move very fast.
Oh, do they?
The reason we have pigeons here and in most of the world is that people use them as racing pigeons, and some of them didn't come home. They're very fast, but they're not as fast as a peregrine. And pigeons are certainly not as agile as a peregrine. You mentioned 200 miles an hour. That's in a power dive. And at that speed, they can do twists and turns, which are just totally unbelievable. They're amazing.
So the nest atop City Hall, the 15th level, a YouTube video of you doing this shows the process and also shows some of your cohorts with wearing helmets and wielding brooms.
Yes.
If you could describe for the radio how that works. I mean, you know, mom and dad are not happy to see you. Thus, the audio at the beginning of the segment, they're telling you they're not happy to see you there, I'm assuming. How do you handle a young peregrine falcon, which I guess can do some damage to a well-meaning human?
Yes, this is radio, so the people listening can't see the scars on my hands. But they certainly get their licks in. The helmets and the eye protection are obviously for protection. The brooms are shields. They are not baseball bats. They are shields. So the person holding the broom, when they see a peregrine diving right for somebody's eyeballs, they place the broom between the bird and the eyeballs. And usually the falcon just veers off at the last moment. But if they hit anything, they hit the broom and nobody is harmed.
So you're giving these chicks, which are pretty sizable according to the YouTube video, by the time you get there, a health checkup. And how do you, what do you do to make sure there's as little damage inflicted on you as possible in terms of banding them and doing whatever else you do?
Well, I handle them gently and I have experience handling them. I don't wear gloves simply because gloves limit my dexterity.
It looked as if they were in a little bag.
Yes. So what I do is I pick them up one by one from the nest, and I place them in a mesh bag. And it's mesh, so there's plenty of good airflow. And then I hold them in that mesh bag until I'm ready to examine them. And I start by weighing them and measuring their leg to determine the sex. And the reason that's important is that the females are larger than the males, so they require a larger band. So we have to be sure that we know the sex. You mentioned the size. By the time we band them, at 3 weeks, they're almost fully grown. By 3.5 weeks, they're just as big as their parents. When I do this in front of school children, then I like to ask, everybody, all of you who were just as big as your parents when you were 3.5 weeks old, raise your hands. They grow incredibly fast. So then I check them over. I make a number of checks. The most important is to look into their oral cavity for evidence of trichomoniasis. This is a protozoal parasitic infection that if they get it at a young age, it is fatal.
Can you treat it if you find it?
Yes. If I find it at the early stages, I have antibiotics with me, and it just takes one dose, and that gives them actually lifetime protection, simply because the one dose stops the infection, and the exposure to their immune system raises an immune response, which then protects them for the rest of their life.
And because they're still a threatened species, it's important to try to preserve every single one.
Absolutely.
There was only one bird or baby in the nest this year. Why?
That's right. That's right. The female laid 4 eggs. Only one of them hatched. Now, it's not unusual for one egg out of four, or even 2 out of 4, to not hatch. 3 out of 4 didn't hatch, and it's most likely because of the female's age. She's 13 years old this year, and at about 11, 12, 13 years is when their fertility begins to drop off. So we were disappointed, of course, but not terribly surprised that only one egg hatched. But that egg hatched into a nice, healthy female chick.
How long do they live?
And she's doing fine. In captivity, they can easily live 20 years, okay? But the real world out there is not so cushy as being in captivity. By the time they reach 10 years of age, they're late middle age. 10, 12 years in the wild is a nice full life. We've seen them live as long as 16 years, but that's really pretty extreme.
We've got a note from one of our listeners, Janet, who says, I saw my first peregrine falcon on Penn's campus going after a squirrel. Does your guest know about these?
My guess is that what your listener saw was a red-tailed hawk. Peregrine falcons very, very rarely hunt mammals. And I have seen red-tailed hawks on Penn campus. They're a fairly common species, and they've adapted well to cities as well as to the countryside. And they are avid hunters of squirrels. So that would be my guess.
Art, my understanding is if you want to get a really good glimpse of peregrine falcons, there's a pair at the bell tower of St. John the Baptist Church in Manayunk.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And this year they had 3 young. They have fledged now. They fledged just a little over a week ago. Unfortunately, one of them appears to have disappeared. The time right after fledging is the most hazardous time in the life of any bird. But there are 2 of them up there. And if you go to, I don't know if I should mention the name of it.
Oh, sure.
Okay, the Couch Tomato in Manayunk. And you sit down there. You can order a pizza and a craft beer and just look up in the air and you will see the youngsters there. So they're 2 young. You'll see them flying around, learning how to fly, playing tag with each other, just like other animals. Playing is practice for real life. So, and you can see them chasing mom and dad, who will occasionally come back with a mourning dove, and they grab that, and mom or dad say, okay, here it is, it's yours, leave me alone.
Sounds like quite a sight. Sounds like you love your job. In 10 seconds, are you optimistic about the future of the peregrine falcon?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Just this last year, they were upgraded from endangered to threatened in Pennsylvania, and the population is recovering well.
Art McMorris, thank you so much for stopping by. Neat conversation.
Thank you, Mary.
Art McMorris is Peregrine Falcon Coordinator for the Pennsylvania Game Commission. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you along for Radio Times.